Just keep going, okay.
Oh, there it is.
I'll say the name again. Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha was the pediatrician who blew the whistle on the water quality in Flint, Michigan. In May 2016, Ladona Brave Bull Award was the landowner who allowed the Dakota Pipeline protesters to use her land. And Candy Brings Plenty, a member of the Ogallala Sioux tribe, she also was at that protest and is part of the Two Spirit Society and works with LBGTQI groupings of Indigenous and Native American and Alaska Natives. This week, a few years ago, Constance Wu, the actress, spoke out against Hollywood's whitewashing of Asian and Asian American characters. And of course, Ava DuVernay. Ava DuVernay, who made The 13th, A Wrinkle in Time, and many others. But in 1890, Margaret Neuenberg founded the Walden School in New York. I'm a bit of a fan of the Walden School, however wacky you think I am. 30 years ago, on May 13th, students began a hunger strike in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, China. And 50 years ago, on May 15th, there was the People's Park protest where Governor Reagan sent in the troops and it said on the website, young hippie women taunted and teased the troops on one occasion handing out marijuana-laced brownies and lemonade spiked with LSD. There's a mural at the park, this is less frivolous, that depicts the shooting of James Rector, who was killed from shotgun wounds. In 1998, the final episode of Seinfeld aired. And of course, I just never want to forget, in whichever year, whichever month, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. But perhaps more importantly, there are other women I admire. 60 to 80% of the world's food is produced by women. Now, of course, they're always disputed, but just go with it for the moment. I mentioned the students because as a faculty member and educator, it is the students who I feel I serve through my work. Of course, I have many other constituencies, staff, other academics. The sharing of knowledge is another constituency, and integrity is another constituency to which I pay homage. In my work, I'm always seeking where women, where people refuse their oppression or their second-class status, where there is resilience and where there is resistance. And for that reason, when I teach about women, about third world issues, about globalization, I do it in order not to deny men, but in fact to argue that when we look at the lives of women, when we look at the daily lives of women, we see how complicated people's lives are, and that leads us to see how complicated men's lives are as well. But I always like to start with the woman. Before that, I used to teach about identity, racism, racism in white women's thinking, and so on and so forth. And one of the works that I'm particularly proud of is that I wrote a paper about research, and I wrote it arguing that we should beware of stereotyping when we conduct our research. We should always look for where difference could lie in our research, and we should also always look for the micropolitics in the research relationship. And what that means for me is that in everyday life, I want to try to beware of stereotyping. I always want to think about where difference could lie. And I always want to think about the micropolitics that happen consistently and constantly in our relationships. So in telling you all of this, perhaps you can have a glimpse into my life and you can see some of what I do. Let me tell you a little bit of my personal biography. I was a scholarship girl at a girls' school in London from the age of 11. We were immigrants to England, and now, of course, I'm an immigrant to the US. When I was 16, I was an American Field Service scholar. I'm sucking cough drops because of my cough. When I was interviewed for this, they said, what sort of school do you want to go to? Why do you want to go to the US? And I said, well, I want to go to an ordinary, big, what are called comprehensive schools in England. I want the corridors, I want the lockers, I want the hustle and bustle. I just wanted to see that. I'd only seen it in movies. They put me in a private girls' school where there were debutantes. I was a sort of hit there. Sort of. I went to university in the UK, but I could only go because universities were free at that point. I could never have gone otherwise. I went to Bristol, where I studied psychology and social psychology. I went to Nottingham, where I studied child and educational psychology. I then worked in different places, like at Leeds Poly and Preston Poly, and I worked as a child and educational psychologist and a clinical psychologist with children. And when I worked at Preston Poly, the head of my department, the chair of my department, was a rather unpleasant man. And in the psychology department, I was the only woman faculty out of 12 or 15 faculty. It's unusual. If you had been there, you'd understand why. When you sat in the cafeteria, the men would sit there saying all sorts of rather vulgar things about the young women who were passing by. And my chair one day, when we were in a meeting and arguing in that way, not in a heavy way, for certain things about child psychology, because I was the expert and I did know, I felt, as I walked out of the room, my head of department gave me the finger behind my back. Now, someone who didn't actually agree with me told me that. And after that and all sorts of other harassment, I reported him. And the solution by the director of the Polytechnic in those days was that my head of department and I should sit down and talk with each other about it. I won't go into the details of that conversation. I don't know if I came out better, but it certainly wasn't easy for him. After working, I then decided I wanted to do a PhD because I was really interested in how working class youth thought about politics. This came out of my own teaching and so on and so forth. One of the things I did when I was teaching about Piaget, who I used to love. And we were all in the classroom and, you know, it was getting to the end of the lecture and the fire drill went off and we knew it wasn't a routine fire drill. So the students started to pack up their stuff. And I said, hang on, there's three more things I want to tell you about Piaget. Well, they didn't listen. But after that, I went to Cambridge and became a student again and behaved in ways similar to how they had behaved. I ended up at King's College and I got a PhD, and perhaps, only perhaps, because I don't know, because it's not the sort of thing I spend my time doing, perhaps I was the first UK-based woman of colour to get a PhD from Cambridge. Now, as Jocelyn said, I put out my research through documentaries. The Shape of Water, which is about women creating social justice around the world, in Senegal, Brazil, Jerusalem, and India. I made a film called Nothing Like Chocolate that Jocelyn referenced. Here, I'm just trying to bring up my website. Trying is the operative word. Is it up?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is just a thing, and then I don't know how to scroll down. But anyway, if you scroll up. So this website, Mirror and Hammer Films, tells you about some of the philosophy behind my films. And I say that we are a film company dedicated to shedding light on injustices around the world. It's called Mirror and Hammer because people have said that Bertolt Brecht, the playwright, said that art must not only be a mirror to society, but must also be a hammer by which to shape society. That art must both reflect and change the world in which we live in. Nothing Like Chocolate is about an anarchist chocolate maker living in Grenada who made chocolate ethically and sustainably. I made a film about an architect who lived in Santa Barbara, Luta Maria Riggs. And that film is about a woman who created the most beautiful buildings, including the Vedanta Temple. If you ever go to Santa Barbara, UCSB, UC Santa Barbara is my home base. If you ever go to Santa Barbara, go to that temple. It's very small, very intimate, and really beautiful. But she was someone who was very feisty. She never washed. She wore dirty clothes all the time. She never did her hair. And when people called her Mrs. out of courtesy, she would always say, "I'm Miss. I have never been married and I never will be." Luther ended her life by, not ended it personally, I mean died after living with a woman, Miriam, for a number of years. I made Via Galapagos, which is actually about people in the Galapagos. It's not about, of course there are the beauty shots of the animals, how could I not do that? But it's about the people who make sure that the islands stay pristine for those animals, so that we may go there. And the film I made this year is a short called So You Think You Can't Dance. I don't know how to get rid of this. So You Think You Can't Dance, which is about ballroom dancing. It's a 15-minute short that's just a fun film, and yet also about resilience and resistance. So how did I get here? How did I become this vice chair and chair-elect of the System-Wide Academic Senate? The reason I got here is because service is very important to me. It's something that I've never been able to get rid of, not that I wanted to, but it's something that it seems to be in the pores of my body. I can never do anything without offering something back, always. To the pleasure of other people, because sometimes what I offer back is not something that they want to hear. I think of it as service. I was a divisional chair at Santa Barbara for 2 terms. And that was when I realized how important staff are in the running of a university. We think of the fact, well, some of us think of the faculty and students, and I just, and not that I didn't know about staff, please know that, but just saw that the whole university would stop if it wasn't for the staff. In fact, when I was at Preston Polytechnic, the director, after I'd taken my chair to him for harassment, asked me and a colleague to set up a project on sexual harassment and what the Polytechnic could do about it in England. And we said we wanted a meeting where all the women who worked in the Polytechnic came to that meeting. Well, the Polytechnic had to shut down for 90 minutes because it could not run without the women. Try that here. I like to think of that as service, and not everyone would agree. I also developed a love for architecture, for space, for public space, for public art and for landscaping. And I particularly developed that because in May 2014, just after I had been elected to do a second term at UC Santa Barbara as divisional chair, there was a shooting in the college town next to the campus in Isla Vista. 6 students were killed and others were of course injured, and everyone was frightened out of their wits. And that was, of course, a very hard time for the campus. It's not a way that I would want the campus to be defined, personally. And yet, there were many things that we had to then think about. One of them was, of course, how to make Isla Vista a community that was one of pleasure as well as learning. It wasn't just a beer-fueled party. But also, I wanted to set up some memorials to the students. Of course, many people did. We had memorials and so on and so forth. And one of the memorials I like to think that Senate was instrumental in creating, I worked with a committee of colleagues from UC Santa Barbara, was we had a planting day. And on that planting day, we bought solar lights with little globes. And this was an artist at the campus who thought of this. And he looked at how the stars reflect on the ground and drew all these diagrams all around the campus. And then we had a planting day where 500-600 people came from the whole campus, which isn't bad. And we all planted these solar lights so that at night, as you walk down the walkway, you could see the stars reflected in the light. We had decided that we wanted memorials that reflected light, fiat lux, cliche, but that also remembered those whose lives had gone, whilst remembering, whilst also being mindful that we had lives to live as well. We also did one other thing. There was a really grungy tunnel between Isla Vista and the campus, 90 feet long, you know, you just cycled through it. And so again, this artist, Marcus Novak, thought of putting in, if you imagine a tunnel, putting in over the curve of the tunnel, little fairy lights spaced 1 foot apart all the way along, you know, this line of the tunnel. And at the bottom, there were sensors, motion sensors. So if you walked through the tunnel, the lights went off at a particular speed. If you cycled through the tunnel, the lights went off at a different speed, and so on and so forth. And the tunnel became a go-to place. Students who were recovering from exam studies would go there. People would play their musical instruments to relax students. And I just heard yesterday that the tunnel is still going strong. It's the electricians who put in those lights, who did all that work, who are keeping it going now, even though Mark Fisher, the campus architect, is no longer at Santa Barbara, and neither am I. So again, a shout out to the people who work on campuses and who support our desire to make our campuses places of pleasure. So in saying all of this, you realize, or I certainly realize, that I am sometimes busy. I have two children. When my first child was born, when she came home, I was on leave for a bit, and then I had to start preparing lectures. Well, I had this three-month-old child at home. I had lectures for classes of 90 students. And I would go into the bathroom 10 minutes before the lecture started, panic, walk into the room, deliver a lecture, and then go home to my child. My evaluations were appalling that year. Don't look at them, please. So, you know, as many of you know, and as the blurb for this talk says, we look at work-life balance. Well, I don't know how we do that. I have no idea. All I know is that I look at the women I admire and take little bits and pieces from them. And there are many women in this room whom I admire enormously and from whom I have stolen many ideas. Forgive me. So what sustains me? Speaking out sustains me. If I can't speak my mind, I cannot sleep. And perhaps that's why the academy is the only place for me. I don't think I get on very well anywhere else, do you? I don't think IBM would want me anyway. And all that service I'd like to do for them. Also, I try to, and this is only an attempt, I'm not at all successful, try to do whatever I can for people who are less fortunate than I am. Yes, I may have come from a place where we had no money in our house for reasons that are a little predictable and perhaps tedious to go into, but I know that I'm very fortunate now. And so I just try to do that. Tracy Chapman once came, played in Santa Barbara, and she got us to write on postcards some things that we like to do. And I wrote down, I try to give $20 every now and then to the people who stand at the end of the freeway ramp, just to make their day for them. It may not be spent on things that others would think were good for them, but it's given a bit of pleasure to people who are really struggling in their lives. Of course, I try to support my children. I'm not sure they would say I do that, but, you know, that's the way that goes. And, of course, my friends support me. That's what sustains me, the love and the support of friends. And I try never to forget that my goal, my reason for living, as I say to the people I teach, is that I want to leave, again, forgive the cliche, the world a slightly better place than the one I came into. And all of that, all of those things are about love for me. And again, perhaps now, you know, 10 years ago, when we started talking about love in our academic work, a group of us have produced some work and so on, and we started talking about love, it was new. Now, of course, many people talk about the importance of love in our lives, in our daily lives, and as academics. But I just want to close with telling you about something else that sustains me. It's a poem by Pablo Neruda, not a woman, who died in the same year that Salvador Allende was murdered in Chile in 1973. I'll just read you bits of it, it's a bit long. Tu risa, your laughter. Quítame el pan, si quieres. Quítame el aire, pero no me quites tu risa. Take bread away from me, if you wish. Take air away. But do not take away from me your laughter. Riete de la noche, del día, de la luna. Laugh at the night, at the day, at the moon. Niágame el pan, el aire. La luz, la primavera. Deny me bread, air, light, spring. Pero tu risa nunca orque mi moriría. But never your laughter, for I would die. It's love and laughter that sustain me. Thank you. Now, I don't know what comments you want to make. I hope that people will share with us some things that have come into your mind. We can have a question. Yeah, go for it.
All right, so is it common for people from your background to get scholarship opportunities at UK?
Was it common? Well, it was at that stage, it was a school that was private, that got some public money, but only on the grounds that it would give, 30% of the girls a scholarship. So, My sisters went to the local, it's called a grammar school, right? We had arrived, my parents, they just went there. I had two sisters. I wanted to go to their school. I was younger than them. I wanted to follow them, you know, hear about, see all the people they talked about and so on and so forth. But no, my parents had heard about this school. So I had to sit an entrance examination. Now, I remember I wanted to go to the grammar school my sisters went to. So I got to this entrance examination, and there were questions. There were questions like, you read a passage, and then you had to answer questions about the passage. You know, how many rooms did the man walk through? How many windows were there? So I read the passage, and the man walked through five rooms. And I thought, well, if I put 345 rooms, then I'll get it wrong. That's what I did. And then how many windows and so on. You get the idea. Okay. Well, dummy. The headmistress, the principal, called my parents in, fact, and said, I can't believe that your daughter couldn't answer these questions correctly. And my parents looked at the answers and said, no, this is not our daughter. And so, unfortunately, the school took me. But I have to say, my four closest friends in life come from when we met at the age of 11. So, you know, every cloud and all of that. So I don't know how common it was, but I was lucky and lucky. Go for it. Oh.
So, given your experience with sexual harassment, and then also your connection to the film industry, what are your thoughts about Me Too?
What are your thoughts? Always deflect. Of course, I think it's important that it's been brought up. Of course, that goes without saying. And there are some heinous acts that are committed, and some not so heinous acts that, you know, shouldn't happen. If I'm frank, I worry sometimes that I am in danger of seeing some actions as being sexual harassment, you know, of the sort that should be dealt with, and we should go to privilege and tenure or whatever, we should lodge a grievance, whatever, when perhaps they don't demand that sort of reaction. Perhaps there are ways for when someone puts their arm around me and I don't like it, if I don't like, you know, some people do it. I know I used to do it, but I don't now. But some people do it, they just do it, and others do it for other reasons, micropolitics. I find it easier to just say, please don't do this, I don't like it. So what do I think about Me Too? I think it's wonderful. I think it's great because it got sexual harassment talked about everywhere. And I don't want to trivialize sexual harassment. So I want to be sure that we all have, if you like, the tools, the abilities, the whatever, to be able to tackle it, both at the official, at the formal level, the grievance levels, and also when I'm walking down the street, if someone says something horrible to me, I just want to be able to say, oh, you know, not very elegant words.
Just a quick follow-up. So I think it was UCLA where the Woody Allen class of students posed that. What do you think about that?
I don't know. Now, all of you who know me really well, which isn't too many people here, but the people who know me really well, when I say I don't know about something, they would fall off their chairs because I have an opinion on everything. But I don't know. I personally don't go and see a Woody Allen film. I just don't. I don't know. I don't know about walking out of a class. I don't know. You know, Althusser, who's someone I used to read, he strangled his wife. Do we not read Althusser? You know? I don't know. That's all I can say. I don't know. Sorry. What do you think?
Well, I mean, your last comment made me think about another question for you, which is student activism and how much that detracts from their education or in your classroom. It becomes political if something happens that you didn't attend the ignited discussion, that becomes polarizing. I mean, that seems like it would be beneficial for students, but I don't know.
I don't think it detracts. Personally, I don't think it detracts. I like to think that I can handle it, that when it comes up and they start getting, you know, upset, that there are ways in which I try to handle my classroom. I'm not saying I'm successful. You know, that we talk about ideas, we're not talking about the person, so you can't say you, you say that idea, and so on and so forth. And people get into the habit, a little bit anyway, of doing that. So I don't think it detracts. I mean, you know, there are things like when I teach about globalization, and someone says, well, why shouldn't we have immigration? Why shouldn't the borders be up? Why shouldn't we build a wall? I've made it clear that you can say anything in a classroom, you know, as long as you don't use horrible words and so on. You can say anything, because that's the place where we develop our ideas. And education comes from the Latin, educere, to lead away from. So what I hope my classrooms do is lead all of us, including me, away from ideas that we're firmly attached to and into new pastures. Someone had a question here.
I was just going to ask, what inspired you when you made that decision to get your PhD? Was there a person, or was it just the job, the potential job itself, or was there something that catalyzed you to do that?
Well, I was teaching developmental psychology, and I got interested in what was called adolescence then, you know, in 16-year-olds, and unemployment was very high for 16-year-olds in England, in the north of England where I was living. 90%, you know, they left school, didn't have a job. And I wanted to know how the youth thought about it. And first, when I told my sister that, oh, I'd run all these surveys and it said the youth are depressed because they don't have jobs, she said, I'm paying my taxpayers' money for you to tell me that. I pointed out I was a taxpayer as well. And from that, I realized I was less interested in the emotional state like that, but I was more interested in the politics. How did people think they could change? I defined in my book, which was called Talking Politics, I defined politics as how you make change, either the state, individuals, organizations, how change is made. And so that was what I became interested in. And I couldn't do that research. I couldn't get a grant without doing a PhD. So I thought, well, why not try it? You know, you've got to take a risk here and there, haven't you? So off I went to be a student. And actually, I wanted to do something very unusual for psychology. So the only person who would have me who would be my supervisor, as they're called in England, was someone at Cambridge, Colin. And so I went there. You know, no one else would have me. Story of my life, isn't it? Take a risk. But hey, look. So no, it wasn't the job. It wasn't the job. I just got very interested in the issues.
I came in late, so maybe I can.
Oh, here. Let's use the microphone so that folks on the phone can hear.
I came in late, so you might have already addressed this, but I see a student why you decided you were interested in being the chair of the Faculty Senate. Great question.
Well, I had done quite a lot on my campus, you know, graduate council to start with, and then must have been other committees. And I was on, you know, the board of the Multicultural Center because diversity is so central to the way in which I like to think I live my life, and so on and so forth. So I did a lot, and then the Planning and Budget Committee were looking for people. You know, it's not always the easiest, by the way, to get faculty to serve on Senate committees. Shh, big secret, don't let it out of here. Hillary, of course, would never say that, nor would anyone else. So I thought, okay, I'll do it. I was told it was a lot of work, which it was, and I loved it. That was the time when I came into my own, because I met people from right across the campus, and so all my stereotypes of engineers, so I'm a sociologist, right? And I work in the humanities, I assign novels in my classes and so on and so forth. But I loved the engineers and the, you know, all the STEM people, you know? And I thought, oh, this is great. We're having conversations where people aren't arguing for their own department, yeah? And so I really enjoyed that experience. I went to Smith for a couple of years in the middle of that because I was invited to set up a journal. meridians, feminism, racism, transnationalism, an academic journal. And then when I came back, they invited me to be the vice chair of planning and budget, and then the chair. And I did like those experiences. I went to London for a couple of years to serve in education abroad as the London Study Centre director. Took the children, who were however old they were, I'm trying to work it out, 12 and 10, something like that. Again, another adventure. Our lives are full of adventures, aren't they? And then when I came back, I was going to some meeting, I don't know, some routine meeting, and two ex-chairs of the Faculty Senate at Santa Barbara said to me in that meeting, not having spoken to each other, one of them said, well, you'd better hurry up and be chair because I'm not going to live forever. And the other said, you know, go on, do it. And so it never occurred to me, and I thought, oh, well, why not? So it was a bit like that. And in the first 6 months, I thought, this was in 2012, I thought, this is impossible. I'm just going to step down. And the Pope had just stepped down. And I thought, well, if the Pope can step down, I can step down. Somehow I didn't. Don't ask me how or why. And of course, I discussed it with my family and so on. And so that's what led me into it. And then I saw the pleasure again of talking with people right across the campus. And seeing, in fact, how unselfish people are and how much people love the University of California, love public education and love the University of California. And that's inculcated, that love, as well as the laughter, never forget that, in me. So, and then when it came to here, again, I had not wanted to do it, and then, you know, someone on a committee in my campus said, would I do it? And I wasn't to be cross with him because he put my name forward already. His name is Claudio Fogu. If you don't like what I'm doing, just get in touch. And so I tried it. I'm still trying it. Let's see what happens. Yeah.
I mean, like, what you have to say about staff, the importance of staff at the university. But as you know, like, among faculty, that attitude is not universal. And there is something, I think, about the culture of the university and the culture of how we run our departments that I think, you know, there's still a whole holdover from feudalism there, right? And as much as we've changed, there is this kind of hierarchical thing, both among the professoriate and then particularly in the way that professors treat staff. And as you've sort of ascended through leadership positions, I wonder what you thought about how we change that culture to see staff more as partners in running the university with us rather than simply disposable cogs to be yelled at if you don't get your expenses in time.
Sadly, that happens, the being yelled at. It's embarrassing, and I'm ashamed of it. So, you know, you've all heard those stories, so you know that. How do we change the culture? I think we do it, I'm sorry to say, on a one-by-one basis, that we show very publicly that we're working with people who are helping us, who are, in fact, that we could, you know, I could never have done planning and budget without the analysts at Santa Barbara who worked on it, let alone chair of the Senate. And, you know, again, okay, not many women. I was the first woman chair of the Santa Barbara Senate, blah, blah, blah. You know, this goes on and on. Not all women are great. We all know about Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May and so on. So let me be clear. I am not arguing for women because of their bodies or because of our bodies that we should have women. But a lot of staff are women. And one day I had to go to a meeting, and I went to room, you know, 1252 or something on the campus, and there was no one there. And so I ran out and said to just the woman sitting, she was in another department, she was in nanoscience, and I said, help, this is a really important meeting. They're all important meetings, aren't they? And I'm not there, and I've got to be there because I want to discuss my views on architecture. So she said, oh, well, hang on. So, you know, and I didn't have a cell phone in those days. Don't ask me why, but I didn't. And so she rang someone, you know, up in the high up office, and they said, oh, yes, it's in room 1252. And she said, no, it isn't. And so she said to me, just start walking across the campus so you're not late. And by the time I got to the administration building, there was a woman there who said, your meeting is over there, you know, come, come, go, blah, blah, blah. And it was like 101 Dalmatians, you know. So the people on the campus had pulled out all the stops to make sure that I could get to the meeting I needed to get to. And so I think that that's the way we try to change the culture. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I know you have views, Sean, so you have to now share them. Go for it.
Yeah, that's what I try to do, but it seems to me that, you know, in our scholarship, we always say, well, individual acts aren't enough.
You're quite right.
When we talk about racism, when we talk about patriarchy, we say individual acts are great, but we need to look at systems as well. And so I don't know either. You're the incoming chair, though, so you should know.
I'm just sort of a task force, for sure.
I'm going to listen to your face, good girl.
Where's the grievance procedure? I've got your email. No, you're absolutely right. And I knew I was dodging it, right? I knew I was dodging it. A long time ago, I worked with women who were incarcerated in California, in the Netherlands, and in Cuba to look at the different forms of incarceration in a clearly capitalist setup, in a social welfare sort of setup, the Netherlands, and then the communist socialism that there was under Franco's Cuba. This was in 94-95. And that was where we argued, you know, that you couldn't just be nice to women who were in jail. We had to look. And of course, that's where we became abolitionists. Well, you know, I like to think we were abolitionists before, but my co-researcher and I, we, you know, argued a lot for abolition of prisons and felt that was the only way. I don't want to abolish staff, by the way. Don't want to abolish faculty either, to be honest. So I don't know. I don't know. And anyone who's got ideas, please say.
I think it's making visible that invisible labor so much as in our I have my thought as well.
Start again.
I think it's about making visible that invisible labor. I think there's been more recent scholarship in the last couple of decades about the labor at research universities at the academic level, at the undergraduate level, the graduate student level, and there's been a lot of organizing and galvanizing communities that way. But I think even so, staff labor is invisible and it's not called out. I had the benefit of having wonderful mentors as I've made my way through the academy, went to Yale, got my degree there, I got my PhD at Berkeley, and I had wonderful mentors who, you know, courtesy and decorum and everything was sort of the way that they lived their lives, and even them, they didn't call out when, you know, you stand at the podium and you thank everyone for the work that they did to bring you there. You didn't really call out staff names. You call out, oh, my colleague here, my colleague there, but you know, Janet, who works the front desk or that makes your copies, aren't called out, you know. And I think it's about, you know, calling them by their names, calling out their work, and calling them into the space, you know. So, I don't know, that's the beginning. It's not changing the system, clearly, but we need to start changing that transcript, right?
I think that's very right, because of course we know that women do invisible labor. You know, we know about the double shift, the triple shift, the quadruple shift now with women doing, you know, volunteer labor. You know, I want a traffic light near where my children cross the road when they go to school. Well, I have to set that up, you know. So you're very right. It's the invisible labor that, in fact, the women at Berkeley have done, have worked on. You know, because domestic labor is invisible. So that's why the 60-80% of the world's food is produced by women. Is called into question, and yet I don't want to call it into question because you don't see what the women do in terms of livestock and so so on and so forth. So I think that's very good. So here we have the beginnings. You see, there's always action. The beginnings of a task force on invisible labor at university.
Yeah.
And I've got a good memory.
And just like to add, you know, if you're thinking of a structural intervention that's like that make that happen, you know, potentially conferences are a good place. I've been in conference meetings, I don't know if any of you have, where sometimes maybe if something, a topic has some relevance to race or inequality, and they might say, we're going to take questions from people of color first. And just, can you, you know, if you're not, can you just go to the back of that line? And it's a little awkward at first, and it's surprising, but amazing and totally different. And so sometimes conferences can be a place to say, you know, how about every person who speaks talks about the invisible labor that happened, you know, or that just, it really, does more than acknowledge their aspiring, you know, grad students or, you know, but people who are also staff on their team.
I sort of, I'm going to argue a little bit with you, Laurie, because we know each other, you know, and Laurie is a sociologist. I'm not, I'm just a sort of wannabe in the sociology department. I think that's right, but I also think that, when we say, in England we used to have this, you know, when going to talks and so on, you know, the women of color would go first and third, it was all awkward. And I started thinking about talking about it. And I think that I want to see if there are other ways to do it, because there are also, if we're just talking about people of color, then, and you know, I'm the first woman of color who's headed Senate. There's also white people who, you know, have overcome many odds. So you're quite right. I do see what you're saying, and I also want to acknowledge that and I know you think this, I mean, I know from working with you in the last 2 or 3 weeks, that we also have to remember. You know, I don't mean remember like as death, you know, funeral, and so I'm going to remember my mom sort of thing. But we have to remember that people have, you know, others have also struggled. So I don't know, and yet I know that privilege that goes with just with how we look and so on and so forth. I don't know where I'm going with that. I don't know, do others have comments on that?
No, I have a new question.
Oh, okay, go for it. And then, I don't know, you want to finish?
I don't know.
I have to also...
Real
yeah,
quick.
Mission day, because
you have
the regions.
Priorities or ideas for when you're going to be chair?
Priorities? Yeah, task force on invisible labor. With a staff member. We get someone also feisty, so the two of them can... duke it out. No, I don't know. I don't know, because I think Robert May is the present chair of the Senate, and he's just doing such an amazing job that I said to him yesterday, I don't think I can fill those shoes. He wears size 12 and I wear size 7. What's going to happen? I need 4 feet. So I don't know. I don't know. And the other thing is, of course, that things come up. You know, at the moment there's a big kerfuffle around Dignity and the UC San Francisco affiliation with Dignity, and that was unexpected. You know, what does one do about places that are defined as Catholic merging with a private place, merging with a public place? I don't know. Is that a P3 or not?
We have time for one last question. I know you said you had to run off to...
I assumed it ended at 1.
Yes, it does end at 1. So why don't we end now? So thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you
so much.
There you go. See, it's already started. We're going to thank for our work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a good afternoon. Thank you very much. Thanks to everybody on the phone as well.
Oh, and thanks for the website. Joseph and I have your.
Of course, please.
Yeah.